Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 731, Interview with John Loftus about America's Nazi Secret. This program is being recorded on December 5th of the year 2010. Once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to bring back to our airwaves John Loftus, former Justice Department investigator and the author of Decades Ago, The Belarus Secret, The Secret War Against the Jews on Holy Trinity, the last two co-authored with Mark Ahrens, also The Witness Tree, and most recently out in softcover, America's Nazi Secret, published by Trine Day. John, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, thank you, Dave. Good to be back. God, we've been covering this story for a long time.
We have indeed. We have indeed. And one of the names that you brought up right at the tail end of side one, another of these powerful Wall Street lawyers and an individual who looms very large in this tale, and that is Frank Wisner. And also in discussing Wisner, remind the listeners again of what the OPC was, the Office of Policy Coordination.
The OPC was the Republican version of the CIA after Dewey lost to Truman. Justice helped the State Department, hired a covert unit, and Alan Dulles picked his friend Frank Wisner to run it. Frank was technically the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Occupied Germany, but in reality, he was America's first covert warrior. It was Wisner's assistant, Carmel Offey, who recruited all of the Eastern European Nazis from the British and smuggle them to America for training. You know, in the event of World War III, we'd have this giant army of freedom fighters behind Nazi lines. Wisner didn't know it, but his deputy, Carmel Offey, was also a Soviet double agent. So the guy that sold him the networks, Kim Philby, was a Soviet double agent. The guy that Wisner had working for him, Carmel Offey, was a Soviet double agent.
Wisner himself, by the way, we should mention, also was a powerful Wall Street law firm from Carter, Ledyard, and Milburn.
Of course. It was all about the money. It's hard for some of my friends on the right and the left to accept this, but these guys really just did it for the profit. They sold America out for money. But, Dave, isn't that just what the multinational oil corporations do? It's not in America's national interest to keep jacking up oil prices with these oil cartels, but it keeps happening. And Exxon's had their best year in decades, while America's economy is down the toilet.
And corporate profits were setting a record this past quarter, and yet America continues to provide tax breaks for corporations to ship jobs overseas. So I think the cynicism is readily comprehensible under the circumstances, but younger listeners in particular should be aware that cynicism goes way beyond denying unemployment insurance to people around Christmas time. It goes to fascism, terrorism, bringing murderers and so forth to apply their trade from the United States. Frank Wisner was bringing people in courtesy of the Galen Organization, and in particular, Einsatzgruppen members. Another name in that looms large here with people like Galen, Wisner, and the OPC, Dr. Franz Alfred Seeks. Who was he?
Oh, he was head of the... He's an academic, a German academic, and he was the head of the sort of the Russian research desk, if you will, for the Third Reich. But Dr. Six was also one of the Einsatzgruppen leaders, one of the SS mobile killing unit leaders. And his job was to recruit the guides, all the Eastern European collaborators, who would help the German army in their invasion of Russia. And the guides, of course, were later installed as the new puppet governments in the area. So Dr. Six was a despicable war criminal. CIA was trying to arrest him. OPC had hired him. In fact, Dr. Six and Klaus Barbie, another famous war criminal, worked for OPC under the code name War Department Detachment. While the CIA was out trying to arrest these guys and have them prosecuted as war criminals, Dr. Six and Klaus Barbie were working for the State Department. So we really had this schizophrenic system. And I think part of it was the Dulles brothers designed an uncentralized intelligence system for America after World War II, so no one could ever put all the pieces together to indict their clients for their financial collaboration with the Nazis or the Bolsheviks. And we actually had 22 different American intelligence agencies after World War II. And the Dulles brothers invented stovepiping. You couldn't just call the guy in the agency next to you. You had to send it all the way up your chain of command to your boss, and he would send it over to the top of their agency and would work all its way down. So there was lots of opportunities to make sure that investigations got killed. So that's what Stovepuppet was intended to do, was to prevent the sharing of intelligence. So my feeling is that 9/11 was not only inevitable, but predictable, because that's the way the Dulles brothers and Frank Wisner designed it.
Seeks was involved with OPC, and again, we are talking about the Belorussian Brigade, which is one of the focal points of your investigation with OSI. How do the Belorussians fit in with Galen, Wisner, Seeks, and the OPC? How is it that you actually came to be investigating this particular crowd, and tie that in with the names that we've already thrown out for the audience?
Well, the idea was that Galen said, I'm going to re-recruit all of these guys who collaborated with us in the invasion of Russia and put them to work to set up underground spy cells behind Russian lines. So Galen said, I'm going to recruit all of the former Nazi collaborators of Eastern Europe and put them back on my payroll. Just give me money and I'll take care of everything. And the Dulles brothers said, sure, what the heck. The Dulles brothers really didn't care about Galen. All they cared about was that it was a perfect cover for national security, a blanket to throw over their corporate clients' collaboration with the Third Reich. So Galen was just a useful cover story to them. And, of course, Galen was totally incompetent. If he'd been any good, the Germans would have won the war on the Eastern Front. But because of Galen, Nazi war criminals were put on the German intelligence payroll, and then the OPC payroll, and then finally the CIA payroll. But at the end, the CIA didn't even know which of their employees were Nazis. That's one of the things I wrote in my new book, was I revealed a memo I had written to the CIA explaining that a lot of their files had been destroyed by OPC. The CIA just didn't know which of their own employees had been previously employed by the Third Reich.
With regard to Franz Alfred Seeks, an SS war criminal and Einsatzgruppen leader, one of the things that you talk about, and that is a series of events involving some of the Belorussians and others, and that is the genesis of what later was to become the Special Forces or Green Beret. And in this context, what we're about to talk about should not be misunderstood as casting aspersions on anyone who was in the Special Forces or implying that the Green Beret are war criminals. Yet, no. The genesis of that organization falls right into this concatenation that you've been describing.
Right. OPC wanted to have, quote, Special Forces, and which later sort of evolved into the Green Beret concept of having local people work with American soldiers to, you know, stir up partisan warfare. And, of course, what the real Green Berets didn't know was that the 10th unit in Germany was largely composed of people that had worked for the Nazis on the Russian front. Here was a disaster that, you know, Special Forces were trying to recruit, you know, Eastern European freedom fighters, and the British were doing the security clearances, and the British were feeding us all of these Eastern European war criminals that they just sold us out. It was a complete disaster. And a similar thing happened years later with the Arab Nazis. Now, most people haven't heard of the Muslim Brotherhood. They sort of began, they put the House of Saud on the throne, then they went to Egypt. The Egyptian leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hassan al-Banna, was a real devotee of Adolf Hitler. In heaven, Allah, on earth, Hitler. And he had an army of 750,000 Arab Nazis. And these guys were war criminals and terrorists. Not one of them was prosecuted. In fact, the worst of them, the Arab Nazi ambassador to Berlin, was the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. He was Hitler's favorite Arab. Hitler personally briefed him on his plans to extend the Holocaust to the Middle East and North Africa. And Hitler's aide said, "My Führer, why would you tell all of our most sensitive state secrets to this Arab?" And Hitler said, "Because they support our goals so enthusiastically." Now, the Muslim Brotherhood was never prosecuted because they were hired right away by the British Secret Service, Kim Philby again, because they wanted to use the Arab Nazi movement to crush the infant state of Israel. Well, that didn't work so well. And so when the new secular Arab government came in Egypt, Nasser was very concerned about this huge army of Arab Nazis running around the country. complete with their original German handlers. So he Nasser ordered them thrown out. By this time, Eisenhower had been elected. Dulles was in charge of CIA, and he had to find a place to hide the Arab Nazis. So he asked the Saudis to take him in. The Saudis liked the Nazis anyway. Besides, most of the Egyptian Nazis were literate. The Saudis gave them jobs as school teachers. So we had a perfect storm of hatred. We had Nazi racism mixed with Islamic extremist bigotry. What the Saudi version of Islam is really a heresy. It's been condemned as a heresy more than 60 times before World War II. So we had Nazis as school teachers in Saudi Arabia. So the chief Nazi propagandist, Said Qutb, his brother Muhammad Qutb, was the tutor of a young man named Osama bin Laden, as well as Dr. Al-Zahri of Egypt. So it's no surprise that these guys grew up infused with Nazi ideology. Now, Dulles' idea, when he brought the Muslim Brotherhood into the U.S. in the 50s, was to use the Muslim Brotherhood as a proxy army of Arab Nazis to fight the Arab communists during the Cold War. Now, of course, it was a real farce, but, you know, during the 1980s, Vice President Bush actually, you know, took the Arab Nazis out of the closet for the last time and used them to recruit the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But this was too much even for the Saudis. They wouldn't let this crazy army of second-generation Nazis back into their country, so they paid them off to stay out of Saudi Arabia and go bomb somewhere else. And they eventually did on 9/11. What the 9/11 Commission doesn't know is that the Justice Department and the State Department had withheld all the Muslim Brotherhood files from them. And there was a huge Muslim Brotherhood support network for al-Qaeda in the U.S. that helped the 9/11 bombers. To this day, America is the only Western nation that doesn't declare the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist group. Even the Arab states do that.
Do you think, John, that it would be fair to describe the Brotherhood activists and also some of their supporters in the corporate community and the intelligence system as literally a fifth column within the country?
Oh, I think so. I mean, the FBI knew that the Muslim Brotherhood was untouchable. You know, the FBI is part of the Justice Department. And they were actually recruiting Islamic terrorists in the U.S., knowing that they were killing Jews in Israel. They were part of the Arab terrorist groups. In fact, there was a very famous case that I got involved with. A professor here in Florida named Sami Al-Aryan, who was actually on the world board of a terrorist group, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, one of the splinter factions of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the FBI was trying to recruit him as an informant. So I got frantic calls from people in the FBI and CIA saying, "You're going to help us. The Justice Department won't allow us to touch this guy." So what I did was I donated money to Professor Al-Aryan's charities and then sued him to find out where my money had gone and exposed him as a major terrorist leader in America.
John, something that I found fascinating, and that is the account of yours and private investigator Bill Warner's gambit in order to help scope out just who these people were. Describe that for us.
Oh, that was hilarious. Bill Warner came to me right after the Al-Aryan case and said he had this great idea. If I gave him the names of, you know, terrorist supporters of Sami Al-Aryan in America, terrorist suspects, he was going to send them advertisements. And Bill's advertisement was, "Try our international calling card free for 90 days, and we hope that you sign up with our phone service." Well, one of the idiots actually did it. And once we had his phone records, then we were able to legally go to other phone companies and purchase the calling records of the people that he called to solicit further companies, customers. So, in essence, we became the Muslim Brotherhood's phone company, and they didn't know it. It was absolutely remarkable. So Bill kept, you know, he remortgaged his house, took out $20,000, and kept buying more and more phone records. And within a year after 9/11, I had correlated those records against terrorist attacks around the world and were able to show, for example, that every time a certain guy in Los Angeles in the Muslim Brotherhood called a Palestinian refugee camp in Jordan, that a terrorist attack in Israel would take place that same day. were able to show 100% correlation against al-Qaeda operations. It was just incredible. So we turned this giant phone database over to Northern Command, part of the U.S. military responsible for protecting America. We said, you know, we think we have a map here of every terrorist logistical support cell in America. And when the military ran it through their computers, it lit up like a Christmas tree. They couldn't believe it. They knew that there were numbers overseas were terrorists. They didn't know who they were calling in America. So the military asked the FBI to come in to help them get search warrants and computer taps. And the FBI typically took credit for the operation. Neither Bill Warner nor I ever got the $1 million reward for justice for, you know, tracking down terrorists. But what did happen is, as soon as the FBI found out that we had identified the Muslim Brotherhood, they all stopped using our phone cards.
And so basically they got wind of what was going on.
Sure, the FBI tipped them off.
And so basically what has happened, and we've seen this in numerous contexts, that people, citizens who were successfully investigating these things at the grassroots level, then had their investigations deliberately deep-sixed by people in the ranks of the Justice Department and other government agencies that are supposed to be doing that very sort of investigation.
I'll give you another example. This guy, Samuel Aryan, I talked about the Muslim Brotherhood, had also set up a gigantic stolen car ring in America. Because you can steal a luxury car in America, ship it to Saudi Arabia, and sell it for three times its value. So we actually found that the purchaser of these stolen cars was a member of the al-Qaeda Golden Chain. That's the top financiers of Osama bin Laden. And the cars that wouldn't fetch a big price, the older ones, were made into car bombs and used against American soldiers in Iraq. We found in at least two cases through the vehicle identification numbers of cars that have been stolen in America, shipped through Alarian's network here in Tampa, and were used later used as car bombs to kill American soldiers.
The overall threat...
Oh, I'm sorry. Dave, the point of this is that the investigation was quashed by the FBI. Secret Service, Customs, ICE were all coming to me saying, what the heck is going on? Here is this major investigation. Never made the light of day. They closed it all down.
And you mentioned that the Justice Department had been trying to recruit him as an informant. Do you think the fact that he was a political ally of George Bush had anything to do with the cover-up?
Well, gee, let me see. Al-Aryan said, I will deliver the state of Florida to you in your first run for president, Mr. Bush. And he did. Al-Aryan claimed credit for offsetting the Arab vote against the Jewish vote in Florida and tipping the scale in the very, very narrow Bush versus Gore race. So Al-Aryan got his picture taken with the president, and, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood became big guns in the White House and in the leadership of the FBI. Now, don't get me wrong, 99% of the folks in the FBI are good, decent people, and they were outraged at what their bosses were doing. That's how I ended up involved in all this stuff again. But it was just a political travesty. It goes back to what Nixon did with the Eastern European Nazis. We actually found a State Department briefing letter in Australia saying, yeah, we know where the Eastern European Nazis are in America, but we keep quiet about it because they're important to get out the emigre vote, the ethnic vote, in five key states. So, you know, just as the Eastern European Nazis were Nixon's, you know, answer to the Jewish vote for Jack Kennedy, you know, Samuel Aryan, the Arab vote in Florida, was the answer to the Jewish vote for Al Gore.
And, in fact, Grover Norquist and Karl Rove went out of their way to recruit people like Al-Aryan and other Muslim Brotherhood functionaries to the GOP, specifically to counteract, quote, the Jewish vote, unquote. John, we've gone through some of the events that led to the scenario that you were investigating as a young Justice Department lawyer. The OSI, what was it? And once you began investigating the crew whose background and history you've delineated for us, what happened to you and the OSI once you began to, basically to wrestle with this buzzsaw?
Well, you know, they discovered that many of the Nazis had been assigned to prosecute were on the CIA payroll. See, I didn't have a clue because these guys had come in from the State Department with phony biographies. And, you know, but it was really an enormous scandal. because it showed that the Attorney General of the United States had disobeyed President Truman and had personally sponsored Nazi war criminals in coming in. So I was threatened with imprisonment if I spoke out. So the way around that was congressional hearings. So I ended up on 60 Minutes and caused a national uproar. Congress demanded congressional hearings. Mike Wallace got the Emmy Award. My family got the death threats. But the congressional hearings, I've now discovered, were fixed. That the Justice Department had gone behind my back and made sure that there was no secret session, no executive session, where I could discuss the classified files. And I didn't know why. I didn't know at that time that the Arab Nazis, I'd seen all their files, were back on the payroll again. That Vice President Bush, back in 1985, had hired the Arab Nazis to go fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And I didn't know that the Justice Department itself was lying through its teeth to Congress, portraying guys like Mykola Lebed, the head of the Ukrainian version of the Gestapo, who were telling Congress that he was the leader of the anti-Nazi resistance. What a horrible lie. So the Justice Department has committed fraud on Congress not once, but twice. And they're going to keep on getting away with it until we put some lawyers in jail. And that's why I wrote the book. I lived long enough to outweigh all the censorship, and the 30-year time barrier expired. Now these guys have to face public inquiry.
And you were threatened with disbarment as well, right?
Oh, yeah. Mark Richard, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General, John Keegan, the Deputy Assistant Attorney General, said disbarred and imprisoned, no doubt about it. In fact, my book, America's Nazi Secret, came out on Veterans Day in November, and before a single review could be written, and 3 days later, the Justice Department leaked a 600-page report to the New York Times that it had prepared, saying, oh, this is all exaggeration. Maybe we let a few Nazis in and we lied about it a little bit. But, you know, they were pleading to the misdemeanor to avoid the felony charges that I was raising. They're not going to get away with it. The Justice Department is absolutely nailed on the case of Mykola Lebed. The Attorney General sponsored him, and the Justice Department lied about him to Congress. There's no way they can wiggle out of it.
One of the things you talk about, there are so many different levels or modes of obstruction for these powerful truths. And again, these are facts and investigations which would reveal the most profound connections between some of the most powerful corporate names in America and some of the most heinous enemies that Americans have fought and died fighting against through much of the century, ranging from the Axis powers of World War II, the Bolsheviks or Communists as they were later known, and most recently Muslim Brotherhood and its various offshoots like Al-Qaeda. When you began investigating that, John, obviously some very direct pressure was directed against you. And you've talked about other types of obstruction. We've only got a few minutes left, but the archives themselves have been deliberately misplaced or set up in such a way as to make it almost impossible to retrieve information.
Sure. One of the things I did for CIA, the funny thing is that most of the CIA were the white hats. They were still out hunting Nazis, trying to prevent these guys from coming in. And I wrote a memo explaining how their files had been shredded and showing them exactly how it had happened. And they were just stunned. So that's one of the reasons why the CIA declassified all of their Justice Department correspondence files for me. And that was what I needed to make the case. I've included some of these key documents in my new book to show exactly how a former Justice Department official who worked for CIA lied to the CIA and then to Congress about how justice had protected the Ukrainian Nazis.
In addition to legislative gambits, media attempts at covering this stuff have been deep-sixed. John, you talked about a Canadian documentary that was basically canceled because of the pressure of a fellow named Steve Roman. Describe that for us, or develop that for us, if you will.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, Steve Roman was the wealthiest man in Canada. He was Richard Nixon's partner in the uranium mines up in Canada. And Roman found out that I was working with Canadian Broadcasting Corporation on a documentary about the Pope's visit to Canada. But we were watching the Pope, filming the Pope dedicating a new Slovakian cathedral in Canada, and we were zeroing in all the Nazi war criminals in the audience. It was a real scandal. So Roman, being a Slovakian, wanted the whole thing canceled, and he threatened to tie up CBC with years of litigation and wreck their budget. They're like their equivalent of, you know, NPR. And the cowardly Canadians backed down, and the show never aired. Now, a similar thing happened. A good friend of mine, Claire Regge, she and I has been working on an independent documentary film for the last 5 years, and it's very powerful. It goes through all the declassified documents now showing how America's finest families funded Hitler. And the film will be released next year, and I think it's going to cause an international scandal, because with it will be a website with all the new documents showing exactly how this stuff happened. Now, just last year, all of a sudden, all of Claire's bank accounts were seized by the IRS. No notice, no trial, nothing. And, you know, luckily she had independent funding to get good lawyers, and that nonsense was stopped. But for a while there, we were afraid that the American documentary was going to go the same way as the Canadian documentary, just get, buried. But I think the truth is going to come out.
John, one thing that I don't I don't think we're going to have time. We're almost out of time in the interview. But this has been recorded in Los Altos Hills, which borders on the city of Palo Alto. And Stanford University, or the Farm as it's known hereabouts, is one of the major institutions. And, of course, a very respectable, justifiably respectable education. You write about Alexander Dahlin. Tell him about that. That was hysterical.
Yeah, he was the former chairman of the history department at Stanford. I raided his offices when I was a prosecutor with OSI, and found that he had stolen, bunches of Nazi intelligence files. In fact, his entire book, Russia Under German Rule, was plagiarized from an SS officer who was a wanted war criminal. And so Dahlin was just a crook. Stanford and Harvard, all the academic community, huge apologies for perpetrating frauds upon the academic community with their so-called Russian research. It was just, thinly disguised Nazi propaganda.
And one of the reasons why so many of these consummately important facts have not come to light is because, basically, a lot of these people know what side their bread is buttered on. John, for many years I've viewed you as a real American hero. I'm a tough SOB. I don't hand out that kind of praise easily. But I had no idea what you had been facing on the physiological front. And I'd like to conclude this broadcast by reading a footnote. And I'll apologize to you and the audience for breaking broadcast etiquette. But on page 46, you write, you're a former Army officer. During the 1970s and 1980s, I had more than 24 surgeries for broken facial bones and sinus damage from a parachute accident when I was an Army officer. The VA missed a few things. In the 1990s, I was also diagnosed by private physicians with colon cancer, prostate blockage, kidney stones, and shoulder damage, each of which required surgery. In 2010, the VA finally discovered that I had 2 displaced hips, several broken ribs, broken vertebrae, and crushed discs, which they somehow missed during the last 4 decades of treatment. The VA conceded that more likely than not, these undiscovered injuries had been sustained in my Army parachute accident. There are third world countries that provide better medical care than America gives its disabled veterans. I have just one word after reading that, John. Wow. I mean, that is an amazing thing to navigate while you're basically tangling with the machinery of the American power structure.
Yeah, no one ever knew how ill I was, but I have a good family. They were very supportive, and I kept up the fight. And I lived long enough to be able to blow the whistle.
And the blowing of that whistle can be found between the covers of America's Nazi Secret, just out in soft cover, published by Trine Day Publishers from Oregon. The author, John Loftus, who has been my guest for the last hour. And this concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 731, interview with John Loftus about America's Nazi Secret. For John Loftus, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. This has been recorded on December 5th of the year 2010.